What's Universal Time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. Monitors say Russian jet fighters on Tuesday resumed heavy bombarding of the rebel-held eastern districts of the war-shattered Syrian city of Aleppo, targeting two opposition-held neighborhoods and killing more than 20 people. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights called Tuesday's onslaught the heaviest Russian bombardment since the government of President Bashar al-Assad announced last week it would cut back on airstrikes. Moscow has repeatedly denied attacking civilians in Syria, insisting its sole aim is targeting terror groups in support of the Assad government. Gunmen reportedly wearing Afghan police uniforms stormed a packed shrine of Shiite Muslims in Kabul late Tuesday, opening fire, killing at least 14 people and wounding more than two dozen others. Officials and witnesses said a suicide bomber blew himself up as the assault began in the Kart-e-Sakai area of the capital city, while two others were shot and killed by security forces, ending an hours-long siege. So far, no group has claimed responsibility for the deadly attack. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan Tuesday warned Iraq's prime minister that Turkish troops cannot be excluded from the military force preparing to do battle with the Islamic State extremists for control of the Iraqi city of Mosul. More than 1,000 Turkish soldiers are already positioned in northern Iraq. Mr. Erdogan spoke in Istanbul, telling Sunni Muslim religious leaders that Turkish troops already in Iraq will not withdraw from the base near Mosul. Relations between the two powers grew tense late last year after Turkey deployed troops to a largely Sunni area northeast of Mosul to train locals in the fight against the Islamic State extremists. Iraq has since called the deployment a violation of its sovereignty and called on Turkey to withdraw. This is VOA News. U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump lashed out Tuesday at fellow Republicans for giving up on his campaign, focusing instead on House and Senate races. With Democrat Hillary Clinton enjoying a double-digit lead in one poll, she was getting some help from President Obama on the campaign trail late Tuesday, who told an audience in North Carolina that Trump is unlike the Republicans he faced in his two previous elections.
I never thought that those people were not honorable. I did not think that if they were in the Oval Office, that America would spin out of control. I didn't think that they couldn't represent us on the world stage. I just thought they represented a different political party and a different philosophy. But I'm being honest here, that is not the case with the current Republican nominee.
Experts are giving Hillary Clinton an 86% chance of winning the election. Top Republicans have seemingly conceded the presidential race to Democrats. Meantime, Hillary Clinton's campaign chairman, John Podesta, says the FBI is investigating the hack of his emails, which were posted by WikiLeaks. Podesta told reporters late Tuesday that the investigation is part of a wider FBI probe into the hacking of Democratic Party emails in which Russia is suspected. Podesta said Russia may be trying to influence the outcome of the U.S. presidential election to favor Republican Donald Trump, who has spoken of his admiration of President Vladimir Putin. South Korean electronics company Samsung says it will no longer manufacture its Galaxy Note 7 smartphone after numerous reports around the globe of overheating. The company announced Tuesday it was shutting down production for good in the interest of consumer safety. Economist Max Wolf is with the Manhattan Venture Partners.
So certainly a sad moment. Samsung, with the Galaxy series, the Note series, invented the phablet, which is the large form factor smartphone, which has caught on like wildfire. Unfortunately for them, everyone makes them now, and everyone else is getting business that's leaving them.
Samsung announced early in the day that it was stopping all global sales and exchanges of the Galaxy Note 7 and advised all customers to stop using the device immediately. The South Korean firm sustained an 8% loss in its share price at the end of Tuesday's stock market trading session. And people in the island nation of Bermuda are keeping a close eye on Hurricane Nicole. The U.S. National Weather Hurricane Center in Miami says the storm is expected to strengthen in its center before it reaches Bermuda early Thursday morning. For details and much more news, join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Wednesday, October 12th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The United Nations is warning of a possible large-scale election-related violence in the DRC.
Actors on all sides appear more and more willing to resort to violence to achieve their ends, while the space for constructive political activity has shrunk still further. If this trajectory continues, I believe large-scale violence is all but inevitable.
Mama Sambo Sidiku is head of the UN mission in the DRC. Meanwhile, an advisor to President Joseph Kabila says there is no need for the president to clarify whether he will step down at the end of his term in December. And several judges and justices have been arrested as part of Nigeria's war on corruption.
The position of faith is clear that it is not the judiciary that is at stake, but individual personalities. The bottom line is whether there exists reasonable grounds for suspicion of commission of an offense.
Abubakar Malami is the Justice Minister of Nigeria. Guinea's government agrees to compensate victims of election violence. We'll have analysis of the surge in violence in South Sudan's Equatorial State and fighting malaria by changing the flavor of us humans. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The top UN diplomat in the Democratic Republic of Congo warned Tuesday that the country has entered a period of extreme risk to its stability as a dispute over postponed elections deepens. From the United Nations, viewers Margaret Bashir has more.
The head of the UN mission in the DRC, Mama Sambo Sidiku, told the UN Security Council that the electoral crisis has become a constitutional crisis with deepening political polarization and no immediate resolution in sight.
Actors on all sides appear more and more willing to resort to violence to achieve their ends, while the space for constructive political activity has shrunk still further. If this trajectory continues, I believe large-scale violence is all but inevitable.
Congo's constitution limits the president to two terms, which President Joseph Kabila will complete on December 19th. But the Independent National Electoral Commission has said elections cannot take place until 2018, citing technical difficulties. In May, the country's constitutional court ruled that Kabila can legally remain in office until his successor is in place. The opposition disagrees with this ruling. Police and anti-Kabila protesters clashed in Kinshasa last month. Authorities said at least 17 people were killed, while the opposition put the death toll at more than 50. Margaret Bashir, VOA News, the United Nations.
Democratic Republic of Congo President Joseph Kabila has yet to say whether he will step down when his term officially ends in December this year. The issue is crucial because Congo's Electoral Commission has pushed back elections and it's not clear who will be running the government after then. VOA's William Klaus sat down with President Kabila's top diplomatic advisor and discussed the president's plans.
In many ways, the Congolese political opposition is deeply divided, but it's united in its suspicion of President Joseph Kabila. They accuse the government of not preparing elections so that Kabila can stay in office. The opposition also argues that Kabila would like to emulate his counterparts in neighbouring Rwanda and Congo-Brazzaville by altering the constitution through a referendum so that he can run for another term. Kabila's chief diplomatic advisor, Ambassador Barnaby Kikaya Bin Karubi, rejects any such suggestion.
We did not do it. Why don't people want to give us credit at least for that? We could have done it when everybody was doing it. Nobody would have pointed fingers at us because it's everybody doing it in the region.
Some senior members of Kabila's political party did call for such a referendum earlier this year. The constitution confines Kabila to two terms of office, and Kikaya suggests that Kabila will honour that limit.
The president has never said that he will seek a third mandate. Never. The president, all he has always said is that he will respect the constitution. It's written black on white that he cannot be a candidate.
However, the constitutional court has ruled that Kabila can stay in office until polls are held. The electoral commission has said that the election won't be ready until late 2018, paving the way for the president to stay in power at least an extra 2 years. So far, the president has not stated what he will do when his second elected mandate runs out on December 19th. Last month, protests over this very question turned violent. More than 50 people were killed, according to human rights groups. VOA asked Kakaya whether tensions might be diffused if Kabila were to make a clear statement about his plans.
He doesn't need to. And they will not do it under pressure from anybody.
The main opposition coalition, the Rassemblement, organised last month's protests and is boycotting an ongoing political dialogue. The Rassemblement says it won't come to the table without Kabila pledging to step down in December. William Clowes, for VOA News, Kinshasa.
In Nigeria, several justices of the Supreme Court and judges of high courts have been arrested and jailed on suspicion of corruption and professional misconduct. Security forces raided the homes of the justices and judges last Friday and Saturday. One local media report quoting a security official said as much as $2 million was found stashed in the home of one of the judges. Justice Minister Abubakar Malami says the operation is not against the judiciary as an institution, but rather it is an investigation into allegations of corruption among individuals in the judiciary. He says some of the judges and justices have been granted bail and some released on their own recognizance.
The truth of the matter is there are reasonable grounds for suspicion of the commission of offenses that borders on corruption and corrupt practices. And then arriving from that appreciation, the need arose for investigation. And the sensitivity and the nature of the investigation to be carried out is an investigation that does not, in the circumstances, require notice for the fair that exhibits could be moved if notices are provided.
Mr. Attorney General, I mean, too often we hear about public officials involved in corrupt acts. Now, how will a justice of the Supreme Court or a justice of a higher court in Nigeria, how would they get involved in corruption?
No. You see, the position of things now borders on investigation. Allegations were made, petitions were written against the conduct of judicial officers. And then regardless of who is involved, whether judicial officers, executive officers, or legislative officers, once there is an allegation of corrupt practices, it becomes necessary and indispensable that investigation must, in the circumstances, be carried out. So it is not about being a judicial officer or not being a judicial officer. It is about the existence of reasonable grounds for suspicion of the commission of offenses arising from complaints that were made against the personalities involved. Legislators, judicial officers, and indeed the executive can all be investigated, provided there are reasonable grounds for suspicion of a commission of an offense. That is the bottom line.
Some legal practitioners in Nigeria have described this. I was reading some articles where they say that the sanctity of the judiciary must be respected. Some even said that if there were any suspicion involving these judges, did the government ever invite them to, you know, talk with them before going to raid their homes?
The position of things is clear that it is not the judiciary that is at stake, but individual personalities. The bottom line is whether there exists reasonable grounds for suspicion of commission of an offense. It is not the institution that is under investigation, but personalities definitely associated with the institution.
Is it mostly about monetary corruption, or that these judges, some of these judges might have rendered some decisions that are deemed to be either fraudulent or corrupt?
Well, it's a combination of the two.
Can you explain that, please?
I said it's a combination of the two. In respect of others, what substantially matters were financial corruption. In respect of others were fraudulent decisions that were believed substantially by the petitioners to be rooted in some corrupt undertones. So the bottom line is that substantially the petition borders on fraudulent decisions that were rooted in financial inducement or associated things.
Mr. Attorney General, do you have any idea how many judges and justices are involved? Are we talking about 10, 15?
Well, I can't give you a clear answer as to the number because the investigation as it is going on is expanding by the day. But the truth of the matter is a sizable number are involved and then investigation is ongoing.
Has any one of the justices or judges been arrested or detained?
Most of them were granted bail on self-recognition.
Abubakar Malami is the Justice Minister of Nigeria. He was speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Today is Wednesday, October 12th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's send shout-out to listeners on our affiliate station, Brela FM, in Nigeria. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. The Guinean government and political parties in the country have agreed to compensate the victims of pre-election violence that occurred in 2013 by both government security forces and opposition supporters. Mamadou Djiambaldé is editor-in-chief of the Independent and Democrat newspapers in Conakry. He says the payments will come from funds created by the government and some international partners.
According to the agreement, the victim of violence from 2013 to 2015 will receive a compensation. So the victim of violence and the victim, they will receive compensation. That compensation will be paid by the government and the partner, like European Union, United States, and Japan.
Who is responsible for the violence now that compensation is going to be paid? Is it the government security forces or both the government and the opposition?
They consider that the government is responsible for that violence because the government forces kill more than 60 opponents during the violence in Guinea.
Yesterday, I ran a story on my show. I talked to someone from Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, where they criticized the Guinean government for not taking action to compensate the victims. Was the government under pressure to do the compensation?
Yeah, the government is under pressure to do it. The pressure from international community and the opposition. So it's why the government has decided to pay the compensation to the victims of the violence in Guinea.
Mamadou, did you say that the compensation will cover both 2013 and 2015? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Now, this came after a national dialogue between the ruling party and the opposition and civil society. Now, is there any announcement about having a municipal or local elections coming up soon?
Yeah, the municipal election will be held in February next year, 2017. But the local election won't be, they will nominate the chief of quarter after the election of the mayor.
Mamadou, do we know when the compensation will be paid and who is going to get the compensation? Every victim or those people who lost their relatives? And what happened to people who got wounded?
The people who lost their relatives and the victims of looting and relatives of people who had been killed. And they will start the payment on June 2017, next year, June.
Mamadou Djiambaldé is editor-in-chief of the Independent and Democrat Newspapers of Guinea. He was speaking with me from the capital, Conakry. South Sudan's former deputy minister of defense says the warring factions in the country are using ethnicity to destroy South Sudan. Majak Dagut said the increase in violence in parts of Equatorial State and the targeted killings of South Sudanese based on their ethnicity will affect relationships among various South Sudanese communities. He says the leaders of the country should create an urgent forum for national dialogue to discuss the security dilemma facing the country.
You know that each of these sectarian constituencies, whether with the government or with the armed rebellion, have widely and seductively missold their agenda of dividing our people and setting our people against one another. For example, in the government circles, the ills of the SPLM, IO, and Riek Machar are overblown, and you know that in the TV and in the radio, in the funerals, in public gatherings. These have been overblown to an extent that nothing is left to keep the social fabric together. Likewise, the opposition people, especially those associated with the SPLM, IO, have used the same strategy of trying to paint a picture that it is the Dinka and it is the Dinka people who are the problem, and it is the Dinka ethnicity which is the problem. And as a result, what the so-called Young Council of Elders do, this sectarian outfit called Young Council of Elders do, is conflated to me together with what the innocent young people who are now being murdered in the highways do. So on both sides of the divide, you see that there is upward sectarian ethnic mobilization. You have heard of what has happened in the villages in Equatoria, that farmers in their fields are being strafed from above using helicopter gunships, that villages are being razed to ground. And you know that in the swamps of Sut in Upper Nile, especially in the Unity State, the Nuer people are being targeted. And on the other side, on the side of the rebels, you know that villages are being attacked. The Dinka villages are being attacked now in Upper Nile. And the innocent Jiang commuters, people traveling between one point and the other in Equatoria, are being targeted. It is because this sectarian and ethnic mobilization has come to its full gestation, and it is ripping our country apart.
These groups that are attacking people on the road, who are they? Who is arming them? Are these South Sudanese? Are these rebels? Who are they?
Well, from long time ago, South Sudan has not been in a position to discharge its mandate as a legitimate authority to provide public security for all South Sudanese. And therefore, you have been hearing of unknown gunmen, journalists have been killed, people who have critical views against the government have been killed, and all these kind of things. In addition, when the conflict broke out in 2013, different groups began to form. Some of them were political. Some of them were accidental, something that you can call accidental guerrillas. And these accidental guerrillas form major part of people who have now become a problem in Equatoria, because some of the youth in Equatoria took to the bush because of the atrocities that they saw being meted out against their villages. This is destroying all of us.
Majak Dagut is the South Sudan former Deputy Minister of Defense. He was speaking from London with VOA's John Tanza. Some people taste better than others to malaria mosquitoes. Scientists say altering how we taste could lead to better insect repellents. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Have you ever noticed how some people are bitten by mosquitoes more than others? Scientists are trying to figure out why and turn that information into a repellent to protect all people from malaria. Such a repellent might be able to put a dent in the 214 million people who become infected every year, mostly in Africa. Some 450,000 people, most of them children, die every year of malaria. Researchers from the Johns Hopkins University have found evidence that smell is not the only thing that attracts malaria mosquitoes to human hosts for a blood meal. Christopher Potter is a professor of neuroscience who works with the sensing ability of mosquitoes. Unlike humans who have one nose, Potter says mosquitoes actually have three pairs of noses. These include two antennae and two maxillary palps, which are fuzzy appendages below the insect's head and are parallel to the feeding needle. At the end of that feeding needle, or proboscis, are the labella, two small regions with neurons that recognize smell and tastes, according to Potter.
So this suggests that the mosquito brain might also have a region of the brain that's dedicated to flavor, to combining smell and taste. And that is something that they're very likely doing when they're actually landing on us and looking around for a place to bite. They're actually smelling us and tasting us. And perhaps that means they're also flavoring us. And that is part of what they're looking for when they're trying to decide who they should bite from and where they're going to bite.
Potter and colleagues made the discovery about the malaria mosquito Anopheles gambiae by making certain neurons in the insect's noses glow green or fluorescence. They wanted to trace those external sensory neurons to the brain. The green glowing label lit up neurons in the brain when they were exposed to complex odors. These help the mosquitoes distinguish between human blood from that of other warm-blooded animals. It's the first time scientists were able to pinpoint the exact location of the senses of smell and taste in mosquitoes. By studying smell-detecting neurons, the finding suggests that it's possible mosquitoes like not only the smell of humans, but our flavor as well.
The long-term goal is to identify better repellents, things that will be essentially better, safer, cheaper, and more effective, that we can manufacture at a more larger scale and distribute it across the world.
The research was published in the journal Nature Communications. Currently, there's an insect repellent called DEET that's widely used in malaria-endemic regions, but it's not 100% effective, and a fair amount of the chemical needs to be applied to the skin to repel mosquitoes. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
The World Health Organization says the widespread consumption of sugar is a major factor in the growing global obesity epidemic. As Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva, the UN agency is calling on governments to tax sugary drinks to lower consumption and reduce this worldwide health risk.
A new report finds more than one-third of adults around the world was overweight and half a billion were obese in 2014. More troubling, the World Health Organization estimates 42 million children under age 5 were overweight or obese last year. This represents an increase of about 11 million during the past 15 years. Nearly half of these children live in Asia and 25% in Africa. The UN agency says unhealthy diets are behind the rise in diabetes, which now accounts for more than 422 million cases and an estimated 1.5 million deaths a year. It says the consumption of sugar, including products like sugary drinks, is a major factor in the global increase of obesity and diabetes. Temo Vaka-Nivolu is the coordinator for WHO's Department for the Prevention on Noncommunicable Diseases. He tells VOA putting a tax on sugary drinks would reduce consumption and save lives.
If we increase the tax and that gets passed on to the consumers, resulting in a 20% increase in price, you are more likely to get, when I say proportional, a 20% reduction in the consumption. In addition, you will be more likely to achieve the ultimate health outcome we are aiming for, which is the reduction in obesity and diabetes.
Vaka-Nivolu says Mexico, which increased sugary drinks by 10% in 2014, had a 6% reduction in consumption by the end of the year. Among poor people, that number decreased by 17%. The WHO report says China tops the worldwide obesity rankings in terms of numbers, with 43 million men and 46 million women. The United States, which has been bumped into second place, has 41.7 million men and 46 million women who are obese. The WHO recommends people keep their sugar intake to below 10% of their total energy needs and reduce it to less than 5% for additional health benefits. It warns people to be careful in their calculations because sugar is everywhere. For example, one tablespoon of ketchup contains one teaspoon of sugar, and an average cup of breakfast cereal contains about 4 teaspoons of sugar. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's it for this Wednesday, October 12th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Botti in Washington, wishing every one of you in Africa a very good day.
On the next Trade Talk Africa, political talks in the Democratic Republic of Congo have resumed after being suspended weeks ago following 2 days of deadly protests on the streets of Kinshasa. We'll discuss the latest developments in the DRC next on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
Hello, Africa music fans. We have hours of the music that you love every day.
Some things change, some remain the same.
From the north to the south and the east to the west, we play only the best. Tune in at 0100, 0200, 1200 and 1300 UTC, GMT, right here on VOA Africa.